Okay, Tim, good to go when you are.
Today is a Dear Lovejoy podcast special, and today, we like to do these every now and then. Today we're having a conversation with David Hamilton, PhD, and he's written a book, The Five Side Effects of Kindness. And it says, caution on the front of it. This book will make you feel better, be happier, and live longer. And that's this podcast.
That sounds advice. Terrible.
Vice podcast, we thought, which bit, living longer
All
or being happier, feeling better. It's going to be interesting because I've spoken to him before, and he found that kindness has this remarkable effect on your body. Here's the claims. Kindness makes us happier. Kindness is good for the heart, slows aging, it improves relationships, and it also is contagious. They're the five chapters of the book, and that's what he's selling it on. He's an interesting guy, David, though. Because he used to work in the pharmaceutical industry for 4 years, so he's not just sort of making this up mumbo jumbo way. And he just one day he sort of worked out that kindness was very good for you and better than drugs, and so he just decided to start kind of like preaching on it, I suppose, in a way. But I'm also interested to know what he thinks of the pharmaceutical industry. If kindness is good as a drug, then what is the pharmaceutical? Well, we'll ask him some questions about that. I'm intrigued by the pharmaceutical industry. I think it's fascinating. Are you a kind person, Mark?
I don't know. That's not for me to judge, is it?
Yes, it is. Do you think you're kind?
I try to be.
You are who you think you are. That's all you are.
What does that mean?
Don't know, but I heard it once. No, it means you are what you think you are. If you go to bed, right?
Cue the music.
go and lie in bed, right? And close your eyes and go, who am I? And you go, oh, I'm a really evil, sadistic serial killer. That's who you are.
No, because people who are that don't think they are, do they?
Right, so you are who you are. Oh, no, that's not true, because you told me the other day, which I agreed with you, that serial killers often want to get caught because they know what they're doing is wrong, so they try and get themselves caught. You told me that, and I think that's true.
I think I've read that
as well. Don't they try and leave clues because they kind of feel that what they're doing is wrong and they don't like it? Anyway, when you go
We're
to...
We're well off topic.
Well, serial killers are not kind, I suppose.
I suppose. Okay, fine. We are well on.
If you look at someone, they've got heart disease, they could be a serial killer because they're not kind. No, so what you've got to do is you've got to think who you are, and then if you're kind. But do you do kind gestures for you? Always, you do lovely things. You cook for your family and you look after your what do you call her, your granny or your nanny or something? What do you call her?
Nan.
Your nan. You look after her, you go around and put her curtains up or something. What did you do the other day? what did you do for her the other day? You went around and did something for her.
Painted the bathroom.
Yeah,
the toilet.
There you go.
Yeah.
You and your brother. So you're kind. And did that make you feel good?
Yeah, but you don't do it to feel good, do you? Do it because it needs to be done.
I think you're kind, Mark. You always say kind things to me. I don't think you're a nasty person, so you're probably nice and healthy. Anyway, David Hamilton is going to tell us all about this. So should we cue the music and meet him?
All right then.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
David, welcome to the podcast. I've got your book in my hand, The Five Side Effects of Kindness, which we'll get into in a minute. But first of all, can you tell us a bit about how you got interested in this?
The subject, I used to work as a scientist in one of the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies. I was making drugs. I was what you call an organic chemist. Nothing to do with organic food. It's like when a kid might stick Lego bricks together to make buildings and cars, an organic chemist sticks atoms together to make drugs. So I ended up in the pharmaceutical industry. But what interested me far more than making the drugs was the process of testing them. You know, you've got to prove that a drug works. So you give a bunch of people the drug and then you give another bunch of people the sugar pill. And I became intrigued with how many people were improving on the sugar pill, on the placebo. So I started to look into the mind-body connection. And one of the things I came across was when people are cultivating a sense of compassion or kindness, that actually has a cardiovascular impact. And because my main field at the time was building cardiovascular drugs, I was hooked. So I really started gradually over the years gathering evidence for all these scientific, physiological, healthy benefits of being kind.
Can we rewind a second then? So, so how did you originally get into the pharmaceutical industry? What had you, what had you done?
So I have a PhD in organic chemistry. So basically,
can you explain? I'll explain that to me a bit more. I don't understand. You're putting Lego bricks together. What does that mean?
Well, for example, water. Water is a molecule that people often call H2O. And what H2O means is there's two hydrogens and an oxygen. So H2O. So an organic chemist pretty much takes the things like H2O and a bunch of carbons, and we stick them together in particular shapes. So for example, alcohol, ethanol, is like two carbons with some hydrogens over there and something that looks like water on the other side. So organic molecules, as they're called, have geometry. So what you're doing with drugs is you're building shapes. Literally, you're building geometry that fits some other complementary shape of geometry in the body.
So what's the difference between organic drugs and normal drugs, is there?
There's not. Right. I mean, I think what people get mixed up with is organic drugs we think of as vitamins and minerals, natural stuff, but everything's organic. Even something that you build in the lab is organic,
right?
Meaning the field I studied was synthetic organic chemistry. So in other words, you build the stuff in nature synthetically.
Right.
So you stick the atoms together, and then what you do when you've got the synthetic thing that mimics nature is you start twisting it and changing the shape. So I might take something that's that shape and then tweak it a little bit. So make like serotonin, for example. Many antidepressants are based on the structure of serotonin. So serotonin looks a bit like almost like a butterfly, funnily enough, if you flattened it out. And so what you might do is you might make modifications to the shape of the wings, but you might make 100 different modifications to the shape of the wings and then test all of them to see if one of them works slightly better than serotonin. And that's where...
What does serotonin do?
Serotonin is the kind of happy drug.
Right,
I
see.
It's a natural happy molecule. So the SSRIs, the antidepressants, many of them are based on the structure or the way that serotonin works. They're a similar shape, similar butterfly with slightly different colours.
So I can see you're very passionate about this. Yeah. Do you still do it? Do you miss it?
I miss the immersion in talking with other organic chemists about it, which is what you do when you're a scientist. You talk about the, you know, isn't this amazing? What we should do here is X, Y, and Z. So I kind of miss that and the laughter about it, because it's like any job. It's you carry on with your friends.
Yeah.
So you can make light of it kind of stuff. I miss that. I still keep up to date. I mean, I read from time to time. I've still got my old textbooks. If I'm looking in my office, I sometimes flick through bits of organic chemistry just because I find it interesting.
What do you think about the pharmaceutical industry at the moment? It just seems to have lost its way a bit. Is it about? Oh, I'm going to be cliche here, but is it about helping the population of the world's people, or is it about helping the shareholders with buying them a car and a luxury holiday?
I think I can a bit of both. You know, it's funny, but when I worked in the pharmaceutical industry, all of my friends, and this is something that I always say to people when they talk about the pharmaceutical industry, all I remember when I was there is my other friends, my scientific colleagues, all of them just wanted to cure cancer. And it's funny, right. It was this idealistic thing. It's like, I'm here because I want to cure cancer. And you find a lot of scientists in the industry, that's their goal. But I guess if you move to the higher echelons of the company, their primary target is shareholder value.
Yeah, because why don't they, if everyone wants to cure cancer, why don't they make it so it's all open sourced? Because if you've got someone from India and someone from China and someone from London and someone from Washington all trying to help, then clearly it's going to be easier to do. But they don't open source, do they? Because they need the profit.
Absolutely. I would love it if it was open source. Yeah. Maybe that's why I don't work in the pharmaceutical industry anymore.
As people on the planet, we've lost our way a bit. If Alexander Fleming had patented... penicillin.
Yeah.
We'd be in a mess, wouldn't we? I mean, there'd be a lot more deaths than there are. And then you got that guy, what's his name, Martin Shkreli. He's the one who bought that drug for £13.50, which is £13.50 hit. And then he put it up to $750. And everyone's going, that's madness. And it's like, well, that's what they're doing anyway, isn't it?
I mean, you
can make drugs for pretty much nothing, and yet they put a price on it. So
yeah.
I don't know, it's a weird one.
I personally would love to see where healthcare is free for everyone in the world. I mean, it's a basic human need, and I don't think it should be monetized. Of course, we live in a system where it is.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes when we focus too much on the money side of it, we do kind of lose our way in what it's actually about.
Okay. Well, we're gonna sort of move it on now to kindness, which is what you're saying there, really. what is kindness?
It's, I guess you can define it as the quality, there's lots of ways to define it, but the quality of being nice, of being supportive, of helping someone, of even being compassionate, of showing empathy, you know, anything like that, that you would say kind of comes from the heart.
Okay, so you started by telling us about you were interested in the placebo effect. Mm. How did that move you on to kindness then, discovering kindness?
Yeah, so I was so intrigued by how many people were improving on placebos. And it's not people band around this figure, oh, placebo is 35%. That isn't true at all. It varies depending on the size of the trial and on the conditions of the trial. You have placebo effects nearly 100%. You can induce a placebo effect, for example, with language. One of the ways you can induce a placebo effect in a study is to make sure the person administering has a white coat, has grey hair and wears glasses and and takes the medicine from a brown bottle, not a clear bottle. And if you dab something like antiseptic on the bottom of the bottle, even though it's a placebo, the mind will assume, well, it must be a really good drug, even though it's just something on the outside of the bottle. So there's ways of inducing. So what you find, placebo effects can vary from 25% to 95%.
On what, though? Placebo for what?
It depends.
Because you're not going to cure cancer, are you, from placebo?
No, absolutely not. And you can't ethically give someone a placebo for cancer. But for what you can study placebo effect for, you know, things like, what you say, called milder conditions, when there's a placebo arm of it, it can vary greatly. Sometimes very high. So I started to look into that when I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And I thought, this is absolutely astonishing. And I remember saying to my friends, look at all the people recovering or improving on placebo. And they would say, it's just the placebo effect. And it was just a sweeping movement with the right hand. Even if they're left-handed, they still do it right. It's just the placebo effect. And I couldn't let it go. And I thought, as a scientist, I would like to know why that works. And it's not just a figment of the imagination. Now we understand, actually, there is no figment of the imagination. When you imagine something, it changes your brain chemistry immediately. Your brain chemistry and activation regions follow what you're doing with your thinking and with your feelings. So I started to look into mind and emotions and what is the evidence, you know, like mindfulness meditation, for example, what does that do when you're relaxing versus being stressed and thinking of someone that bugs you? What's the difference between thinking of someone who annoys you or thinking of someone you love? And it was that kind of train of thought, that looking through medical journals on stress versus other things, that when I stumbled across research on a Tibetan Buddhist process called the loving kindness meditation, where you cultivate a sense of kindness and compassion for loved ones, for even challenging people in your life, which is a bit more difficult, and measuring, you know, physiological effects of that and other types of stuff. So I just over the years, I started gathering all that evidence and decided one day I would write a book on kindness.
So this isn't your first book on it, is it?
No, no. I wrote a book called Why Kindness is Good for You about 5 years ago, actually. And I was so pleased with it, but it hardly sold any copies at all. And I wondered if it was because of the title, or if it was because are people just not interested in kindness, or is it because it was all about the science of what happens in the body? So I just kind of let it simmer away. And then I wrote a blog on it 5 years ago called, basically taking the content, I wrote called The Five Side Effects of Kindness. And roughly every month for 5 years, that blog's had 1,000 page views from all over the world. And I thought, wow. So I decided I'm going to redo the book, but make it shorter, put some illustrations in, make it sleeker, easier to read, a bit more lighthearted, and also with brand new content. And so that's really where the book came out of.
We'll go through the book in a minute, but what does actually kindness actually do then? What's if I'm being kind, let's say I'm helping someone across the road and I'm doing lovely stuff for charity, what is actually happening? Is it a thing happening in my brain?
Yes.
What is actually happening?
And throughout your body. A couple of things happen. When you're being kind, it makes you feel warm. whether it's a satisfaction or, in fact, we are genetically wired to produce a hormone called oxytocin. Hmm. We're genetically wired to produce that when we emotionally connect with another person. Either even physically, if it's warm, if it's physically warm versus a kind of grasp in your arm, which isn't emotionally warm, but if someone touches your arm lightly in a compassionate way, your body will produce oxytocin. So the body is genetically wired to generate oxytocin when we are being emotionally warm. And that is something that occurs when we are being genuinely kind. And I say genuinely, you have to mean it. But when you be genuinely kind and supportive, your body produces oxytocin, so does your brain. And what it does is it dampens down some of these stress and depression areas of the brain, which is why you find that if you look at some kindness studies, they are diametrically opposed the effects to stress. Because when we do acts of kindness, it seems to reduce the amount of stress that we experience in life. The more kindness we do, the less stress. Doesn't mean that stressful events don't happen in life, but it seems to somehow the changes in the brain seem to buffer the effects of stressful life situations. Doesn't mean they don't happen, but we feel slightly differently.
Okay, so you're linking then stress to illness. So the oxytocin stops the stress, which then prevents the illness.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that happens.
So the oxytocin the kindness isn't curing the illness, it's stopping it happening in the first place.
It's cutting down the stress that would trigger something in the first place, yeah.
And stress is well known now, it's very bad for you physically.
Yeah.
Mentally we know, but physically as well.
And emotional stress especially. One of my favourite pieces of research, I think favourite for its title, is called Marital Conflict Relations and Coronary Artery Calcification. You could probably work out what that's about. Yeah. Marital Conflict Relations and Coronary Artery Calcification. It's where the coronary artery, instead of having the consistency of a poached egg, is something like plasterboard. And in this study, 150 married couples were invited into a room and they were videotaped for half an hour while having a discussion. And the scientists had given them topics to discuss, you know, stuff that couples might disagree on because they wanted to see real life. So you might talk about the, you know, education of the children, what's happening with the household finances, the renovations of the house, even vaccinations, anything that you might disagree on. And they videotaped them and they began to code the behaviours. And what that means is for every, say, time someone showed patience and decided to listen rather than get in with their own opinion, we'd get a plus score, maybe plus one or two. If someone showed real compassion, then they might get a plus three or four. But if someone showed hostility or aggression or contempt, then they might get a minus score, a minus three or four. And what happens is you add up all these scores and you can start to categorise the couples. And what they found at one end of the extreme, you had those who were most hostile and aggressive, and the males in that category were bullying type personalities. At the other end of the extreme, and you had divisions in between, of course, but at the other end of the extreme, you had those who were more kind and compassionate, more softer. You could say they were more heart-centred. Well, and one of the most amazing symmetries I've ever come across in science, and what I mean by a symmetry, one thing's reflected in another. Those who were hardened towards each other, hostile, aggressive, they had high levels of coronary artery calcification. And the ones who were heart-centered, kind and compassionate, they had healthy arteries. When you took out of the equation diet, lifestyle, smoking, drinking, all that kind of thing, the only difference in the study was how the people were, how they were behaving towards one another.
So what's happening to your body to calcify?
What you're doing is, there's a couple of things that happen. When you're being kind and compassionate, you're generating oxytocin. And what that does is it's called cardioprotective. It's a cardioprotective hormone. It means it protects your cardiovascular system. And it does it in a number of ways, which I'll explain in a second. But when you're being hostile, aggressive towards people, you know, contempt towards people, bullying people, for example, you're literally cutting off your supply. You're cutting down your natural production of oxytocin. Because remember I said it's generated through emotional warmth. We're genetically wired to produce it when we're being emotionally warm. So it's vital for human survival. It's one of the oldest genes, actually, in the human genome, 500 million years old. Yeah. So when we cut off the supply through being unkind, but aggressively unkind, then we have no cardioprotection. So there's no natural mechanism then to keep the arteries clear. So that's one of the reasons why the couples who in that group who were being hostile, aggressive and angry, it's one of the reasons why they had hardening of the arteries. The other reason is the stress itself, left to its own devices, gradually causes the production of things called free radicals in aging. And a free radical is just the stuff that causes, if you put an apple on the table and leave it for a fortnight and it wrinkles, that's free radicals. It's called, other people call it oxidation or oxidative stress, but it's caused by free radicals. The same process actually that wrinkles our skin. So that occurs inside the arteries along with inflammation. You know what inflammation is? You cut yourself, it gets inflamed. So the oxidation and the inflammation occur in the arteries as a side effect of consistent stress. And gradually that can lead to a plaque formation, you know, plaque, buildup of plaque, calcification. And so that's really why a long-term consistently stress is implicated in heart disease.
Are you a lone voice on this, or is it well known?
It's not very well known, actually. One of the reasons I wrote in this field is because no one seems to know about it. And so, you know, I've had numerous conversations with GPs who had absolutely no idea that being kind could actually have an effect, and also no idea that oxytocin is cardioprotective.
Do they believe you?
Mostly, well, now I think they do, yeah. In fact, I was playing tennis with a GP quite recently. So you find that people, if you explain it with science and use some of the language that the other scientists and doctors would understand, then I find that they're very willing to listen. It's just, it's not the kind of thing that, you know, doctors might have learned in medical school, because a lot of this research is relatively new.
It's funny, you said, we had a sleep expert on, one of the leading sleep experts in the world on our podcast not so long ago, and he was saying in the 70s no one really cared about sleep that much.
Yeah.
And then he started investigating it, and still it's taken a long time, but now they it seems to be really moving forward on sleep. Seems similar to this, because there's a lot of talk about mindfulness, but it is categorized along with Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I don't know, new age or self-help.
Yeah.
It's not put in the realms of, what would you call it? I want to use the word normal medicine, but I think that's discriminatory. What?
Science.
Yeah, maybe science. Science is good. Thank you, Mark. Science. So how long before we get it into science then? Did they do more research on it?
Yeah, I think keep the research going, but also tell people about it. You know, I find, like, I communicate, I bring science into things. Even, you mentioned mindfulness, you know, few people know. When talk about people who think it's Buddhism, but mindfulness really just means you become mindful of the fact that you're breathing.
Yeah.
So I breathe all the time, but I don't notice it. But if I notice it, I become mindful of the fact that I'm breathing. Amazing things happen. You actually cause a flow of resources to the front of the brain. And if you do it a lot, it's like spraying fertilizer on your garden and your plants grow. What you actually do is you fertilize the part of the brain above the eyes. It's called the prefrontal cortex. And it actually grows like a muscle. It's like you're taking it to the gym. Now, what that area...
This is through mindfulness.
Through literally just becoming mindful of the fact that you're breathing.
Right.
So when I explain that to people, that you're actually causing physical changes to the front of the brain that give you more ability to control yourself, ability to think in particular ways, to override knee-jerk emotional reactions, a better ability. Meaning we're all becoming Olympic champions, aren't it? But better than you were before, an improvement. I find when I explain it in that kind of wee bit of science into it, then it takes the spiritual stuff side away a wee bit. It takes the woo-woo out of it. So I'm trying to do the same with kindness. And trying to take that kind of seeming woo-woo out of the subject and saying, well, actually, this is hard science. These are natural biological processes that we tap into all the time without realising that we're actually doing it.
What does the word woo-woo mean?
Woo-woo. It's just, you know, I've never been asked that, funnily enough. You know, people go woo-woo and they do inverted commas.
I don't really know. You know, no.
I think it's a term associated with kind of spiritual hippies, angels and crystals and stuff like that.
Okay.
People refer to it as kind of woo-woo.
As the woo-woo.
Yeah, and so it, not that that's fair really, but people categorise mindfulness and even compassion and kindness, they put it in that category.
Yeah.
and I don't think that's fair. Also, and also, it takes it out of the mainstream,
right,
by putting it in that category.
One of the interesting things in your book was someone who there was an example of someone who cured themselves of depression.
Yeah.
Look, severe depression.
Yeah.
By just changing their life, changing the way they are to become kind.
Yeah.
That really works.
It does. Do you know, it does for a lot of people. It depends on the person.
Can you explain the example to us as well?
I think you're referring to the example of a lady, yeah, called Margaret McCarthy.
That's right.
Yeah. Who's a personal friend of mine. Yeah. So Margaret.
Okay.
Margaret had made a few suicide attempts.
Yeah.
In her life, and she'd been in a locked ward for a month, sectioned under the Mental Health Act. She'd been through electroconvulsive therapy, which didn't do anything for her, and she was really. She was seeing a psychiatrist regularly, but just not getting anywhere. And she watched the film Patch Adams, featuring the late Robin Williams, one of my all-time favourite actors. And she decided, she got a hold of his fax number. I don't know how she got it, but she sent him a fax. Now, this was
Patch Adams.
Patch, yeah. Adams, yes. Yeah, so she's, you're not Robin Williams. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, she sent the actual, yeah, real Patch Adams. She sent him a fax. This was in 1999, I think, or 98. She sent him a fax and explained her situation, her suicide, and said, could I come to your hospital? Because in the film, they talked about he wanted to build the Gesundheit Institute.
I don't know what that is.
It was basically going to be a free hospital,
right,
that offers free care.
Right.
And anyone can come, but part of the treatment will be laughter and helping others.
Right.
Will be helping as part of the whole, you've got to serve each other, you've got to make it lighter, and there'll be, everything's free. And that was his dream. And so Patch faxed back on the same day to Margaret, and she said to me that was something really significant. The fact he cared enough, because her experience as a mental health patient, she said the staff in the hospital lacked compassion.
Right.
She said they absolutely lacked, and that's not a criticism. I don't know, mm-hmm, people in that place at all. I can't really comment, but Margaret had that experience that they had no compassion for her. And here was this man, Patch Adams, she's never met before, and he faxed her back on the same day. And he said, as you know, Margaret, I had a suicide attempt. I suffered terribly. What I've learned, though, is this. Go out and serve. Serve others and see your depression lift. And that was like a clarion call. Margaret got the import, because it was a longer fax, but that was the key of it, is service of others will actually help to take some of the pain, the sting out of the depression. So her and her husband, Kenny, they joined a volunteer organisation. They started to volunteer, helping other people who were struggling in their lives, Befriending, I think it was called. And within a couple of months, Margaret's life had changed, because rather, and this is one of the ways that it kind of works, is when you're focused on helping other people, it takes the attention away from how you feel. Even if it's a momentary thing, but the more you're doing it, the more it begins to take your attention away. And for Margaret, it was absolutely life-changing. And Patch's Institute actually had echoes of, before the era of pharmaceutical medicine, one of the best-known treatments for depression was called moral treatment. And that was started in the 18th century by a Quaker, William Tuke, I think. And it was called the York Retreat. And it was depressed patients who were brought to this house. And the treatment was service of each other. Everyone had to care for each other, depending on the particular mental illness you had. And it was so successful that it actually became part of the... taken on board by the Quakers, and it swept America. And American psychiatrist actually believed it was so successful that it must physically change the brain. We actually know that to be true nowadays.
Mm.
But that was before pharmaceutical medicine. One of the key treatments was the service of other people.
Do you think depression can be linked in some cases to an artificial world we've created, which is one which isn't so kind? And we have created a sort of artificial society, haven't we?
I think so. For some people, I think depression can happen for different people in different ways, and there can be different reasons and backgrounds. But I would say, generally speaking, a lot of people, I think we intuitively know that we're supposed to be nice to each other. We're supposed to.
So what happened to that lady when she started being kind then? What was the actual effect of that on her depression? On her, is it her brain?
It definitely affects the brain, because when you're coming, if you're replacing being kind with depression, then you are fiddling about with brain chemistry. In fact, one of the things, as well as oxytocin that you produce, which is actually a natural antidepressant in itself, what you also elevate is things like serotonin, which is what antidepressants try to lift, dopamine, which is another thing that's associated as a natural antidepressant in some respects. And we produce that when we're doing something that feels like the right thing to do. It's almost like we're rewarding ourselves. This is how I'm supposed to be. And another thing we generate in the brain is the brain's natural versions of morphine and heroin. So morphine and heroin are called opiates,
right?
But there's some evidence that suggests that being kind generates endogenous opiates. And what an endogenous opiate means, it's endogenous to the body. So it's almost like it gives you a high. And maybe that's why a guy wrote a book in 1979 called The Healing Power of Doing Good. A guy called Alan Lux, I think he was a epidemiologist or a sociologist or something. And he coined the term helper's high, because he did research of over 3,000 people who were regular volunteers. And what he found is that 95% of them reported what he defined as helper's high, that immediate feeling of warmth and good feeling of satisfaction and what you might call a psychological or emotional elevation. We now call the term elevation, but originally it was called helper's high. It was that elevated feeling you get.
You believe that we're supposed to be kind, that we're naturally kind people.
Yeah. I mean, there's always exceptions to the rule. In fact, one of my favourite jokes, I heard Billy Connolly talk about this once. He said, there's two nature filmmakers in the African savannah, and they're filming wildebeests, and all of a sudden they see this lion, and the lion's coming towards them, and it's doing the over-shoulder thing like that. It's moving its shoulders, and it's looking at them. And one of them turns down into his bag and starts changing his shoes, putting on a pair of Nike running shoes, and he's tying up the laces in his Nike running shoes, and his friend turns around and said, "You will never outrun a lion." He said, "But if I can outrun you..." So we've got this natural... We've got the tendency for selfishness as well, but I would say we have a slight bias wired in us to be helpful and friendly. And I mentioned earlier, the oxytocin gene is one of the oldest in our genome. And it's been conserved, and what that means is it's present in humans and all animal species. It's vital for bonding and connection. It's integrated itself in that time into just about every important, meaningful system in the body, from digestion, from the growth of cells. In fact, your heart cells need oxytocin. Your brain cells require oxytocin to grow. All the main cell types require oxytocin, actually. So we are literally wired for the production of oxytocin.
But we had Will Storer not so long ago, and he talks about the culture of being selfish and how we've created a culture of being self-obsessed, really. And that doesn't go hand in hand with... And we've been taught this since the big boom in the 80s, Thatcher and Reagan. That doesn't go hand in hand with kindness, does it? It's survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
Everything's a competition. You're either a winner or you're a loser. That's not kind, is it?
Yeah, I see what you're meaning there. I think intuitively, we want to be kind. And so this, when we start creating an artificial world, as you mentioned, where we're pursuing artificial things, sometimes it can take us away from our nature. And our nature is to look out for each other.
Yeah. Grenfell State, all the terrorist atrocities, there's always this massive outpouring of kindness for people. And people seem shocked by it. But I don't think it is shocking, because that's how naturally everyone wants to help each other. And you look around and everyone gets a... It's a horrific things which happen, but everyone gets a nice warmth from it as well, is that everyone's being so lovely and kind.
Yeah, and what I love seeing now is that's been reported in the news.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was always the case. You know, a natural disaster, and what you're seeing is the thousands of people who are, you know, GoFundMe and whatever these other websites are that are helping people, their websites created that allow other people to express their natural tendency to care. And I love the fact that that's happening now.
What about careers? Because I always say this thing that if you work in medicine or you work as a teacher or you work in a care industry, you're going to have the greatest life ever because when you go to work, you're going to feel good about yourself all the time. That's what basically you're saying. What about all the careers which, because the careers that we all look at and go, wow, they're amazing. They earn a lot of money. Say, let's just take lawyers, for instance. Now, there are obviously some fantastic lawyers out there who do amazing things for people who can't represent themselves. But what about if you're a lawyer and you're fighting a case and you know for a fact that you're on the wrong side, but you do it. Or you're a banker and you know that you don't really, you're just doing it for money. Or you're a salesperson, you're trying to upsell something, thinking this person doesn't really need to be doing it. It's all that stuff. Or a TV presenter, yes, Mark, thank you. Are all these things detrimental to your health, do you think, if you're doing something you don't genuinely believe it's good for the person you're doing it for?
Yeah, I think for some people it will naturally get to them and it will start to create psychological stress on the inside because you don't really believe in what you're doing. Other people can sweep that aside. In fact, there's a relationship between empathy and seniority in an organization, and it's like a triangle, it's like a pyramid. It's not absolutely true, but generally speaking, what you find is the higher up in an organization someone goes, the less empathy they have. And it's not an absolute rule. I've met some really senior people who are exceedingly compassionate, but generally speaking, statistical bell curve, generally what you see, and you see the same in the financial services, the higher up you go, the less empathy. And part of the explanation I read in some research once was you have to learn to make decisions that affect the lives and well-being of other people. And initially it gets to you, but you've got to almost block it out. So you literally learn to block it out. And what you're doing is you're, instead of exercising the empathy regions of the brain, they actually shrink. Because if you don't exercise a muscle, it atrophies, it shrinks.
Yeah.
If you don't exercise the empathy regions, then again, what happens is they shrink. And so you actually have learned to become less caring for other people. So we can actually learn it, but we can also relearn empathy. The brain is neuroplastic, meaning it is always changing. And it changes according to what you're doing, what you're learning, and the experiences that you create for yourself.
I suppose when you see things, the employers like Google, that's the one I can think of off the top of my head, where they put on food for their employees, and they have amazing facilities. They've learned that being nice, being kind means that the people feel good, and they. I think they generate more work, don't they? Isn't it proven that?
Yeah. In fact, the more you're enjoying your job, the more creative you become and the more productive you become. So they've literally, I think they've nailed it, you know, with that kind of whole playful attitude. If you create a playful, a place that people come to do something they enjoy doing, then you're not going to have a high staff turnover.
So should you choose wisely in your career?
Yes, but also, I mean, I personally couldn't do a job if I knew that what I was doing was harmful to people or it wasn't serving people. But then everyone's different. Everyone's got their own thing. But you don't have to be a teacher or a nurse or a doctor. Whatever you're doing, let's say you work in IT, there will be opportunities to help other people.
Yeah.
And so I say that to people. Whatever your job is, whatever situation you are, look out for opportunities to help people. There'll be someone two desks down who's struggling to attach a file. How do you attach a file? Mm. Oh, let me help you, kind of thing. And it's these small, meaningful acts in our daily lives, regardless of the career that we have, that give us an opportunity to connect with each other and to be kind.
And there'll be people listening to this going, it's all right for you, Tim. It's all right for you, David. You've got good jobs and you're all right. I need to bring money home for my wife and kids, or husband and kids, and or just kids. Got to do the whole range there. So you know, I can't afford to choose that. And you're right, just find kindness, I suppose, in other ways. What about being kind to yourself? Does that count?
It does, and it's very, very important.
Oh.
It's linked with self-esteem. Some people call it self-care. Hmm. That if we don't look after our own needs, then it generates stress. We become stressed. And so one of the important pillars, I guess, of building a healthy self-esteem is being willing to look after your own needs and not thinking I'm not worthy enough, because a lot of people actually think I'm not important enough, and it's not a conscious thought. It's an assumption that everyone else is what is more valuable than me. Everyone else has more worth than me. So some people do not look after their own needs for that reason. It's a more deeper psychological thing. So training ourselves to care for ourselves, to be kind to ourselves, for many people is of fundamental importance.
Which is what Will Storrs said, that there's so many ways to fail in modern society now, because we've got so much to live up to that we continue to look at ourselves as failures,
yes.
which then can mean that we...
It can dent our self-esteem.
Yeah. And that becomes unhealthy.
Yeah.
Your book is called Five Side Effects. Why side effects and not effects?
Because I used to work in the pharmaceutical industry. And I thought I'd repackage the term. But you know, a side effect really means something that happens alongside the thing that you're trying to do. So a side effect can be anything that happens alongside what you're trying to achieve. So I decided that I thought that kind of, do you call it a juxtaposition of the title, whatever it's called, that I thought that would be quite a catchy title anyway, right. To call it a side effect, because people go, wait a minute, kindness, side effect, you know, and I thought it would just get people's attention, and that's what I wanted, is to bring people's attention to the information.
And how's it gone down? Are people? I know it's not your first book, but are people taking it seriously?
Gradually, kind of gradually. It's like, you know, any book. I think it can take a little while. I'm not very good at promoting my stuff, so I tend not to do it very well. You know, so my books take a little bit longer than other people sometimes to get out.
You're too kind. That's your problem. Is it frustrating for you though? Because you obviously know something that is valuable, and it's valuable to the world, really. If you think about it in big terms, big scheme of things, I mean, the world's very unkind to each other. There's a ridiculous distribution of wealth. We could solve a lot of the problems, as we were discussing earlier, the pharmaceutical companies, if they were all very kind and open sourced all their drugs, we'd heal, cure a lot more diseases. So is it frustrating for you to see, actually, to get the message out there, is it frustrating that more people can't see what you can see?
Not so much frustrating. I guess I'm more focused on the other side of it, that I'm determined to get this stuff out. I think I could be frustrated if I looked at it that way, but I think I'm just very focused on, and also I have a belief, I wouldn't call it faith, I guess is the wrong word, but I have a feeling that people are going to come to this, that, you know, and for example, the fact we're having this conversation just now is because you find it interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm finding the same. I mean, Lady Gaga's office contacted me quite a wee while ago to say they would love to partner with me, because they have a thing called Born This Way Foundation, which is about teaching kids to be kind to each other and promoting that. So I think rather than me trying to promote and do this, I'm finding now that other people who are in better position to talk about kindness, who have a louder voice, meaning they have a bigger reach, they have a bigger audience, I'm finding they're beginning to find this book and find the topics and become the voice of it. So I'm not that bothered whether it's me or not, as long as the information gets out there.
Have you met Lady Gaga?
Not yet.
No? Not yet. Have you been over there to see them?
No, I've just had a few conversations. We did this, Cynthia, her mum, I spoke to Cynthia on the phone.
Cynthia Gaga.
Cynthia Germanotta. Yeah, we had this wee conversation on the phone. Then we did a Twitter chat.
Yeah.
So it was a 1-hour conversation with people through Twitter were putting questions in. And then Lady Gaga tweeted it just before we started it to her 65 million followers. And the screens went ballistic. We got 75 million impressions. That's amazing.
That is amazing.
So we're having a 1-hour online chat about kindness, and we got 75 million impressions. And I started out with just my laptop screen. By 10 minutes into it, I had the laptop, the iPad, the the iPhone, and I was on the phone to the office because the screens were changing, updating with retweets. The screens were just whizzing down and no one could keep track of the questions.
Yeah.
So Born This Way Foundation had to just randomly select from the updating screens meaningful questions, and then they would pitch the questions to Cynthia or to myself, and we would have the Twitter, the small amount of chunks of text you get in Twitter to type a reply. But these replies were going out to huge amounts of people, so I was really warmed with that. That wasn't me trying to promote me. It was that was a subject I'd written on, and someone who was much better placed to tell people about it came forward.
I think we've got a slight problem in the world at the moment. I think we've got a huge wave of empathy happening, and I think it's happening with people like Lady Gaga and lots of others who are just sort of realizing that we should be caring, loving. Yeah. But meanwhile, let's just take the entertainment industry, something that I'm part of. Everything is a competition. You win everything. Everything is up against each other. You're sort of being told from another that being kind doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It's not the way to do it. If you want to win something, you've got to be selfish. And so I think we're giving out mixed signals. And I think it's a lot of it is a problem with my industry, and a lot of problems is to do with marketing of products and stuff because people want to make money. A lot of it's money-based, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That side of things.
And I think we've fundamentally got something back to front with, you know, people talk about the selfish gene and they think we're wired to be selfish, so we might as well do it. And that's given so many people a license to just run over other people, in my opinion. But the selfish gene doesn't actually mean we're selfish. All the selfish gene actually refers to is the process of evolution by natural selection and how a gene itself, how it actually gets passed on. That's all the selfish gene actually refers to. But people have misread what the selfish gene means, and what it's done is I think I read it somewhere that it's given license to people in many industries and companies to let us say, we're supposed to be selfish, we're supposed to compete. And it's not, evolution isn't about competition. In fact, new evolution theories show that our species thrives not by beating each other, by out-competing, but by cooperating with each other. And the only way a species can actually survive, it's now been shown in evolution, the only way a species could survive is through cooperation, not competition.
I remember arriving in my industry years ago and everyone going, it's cutthroat, TV, it's cutthroat, watch your back, everyone's out to get you, everyone's out to get your job, everyone's out to stab you. Meanwhile, in the, stab you in the back, sorry, everyone's, meanwhile in the journalism world, there is that thing where, again, it was cutthroat in the newspapers. And what that produces maybe is that people are so desperate not to be beaten that the standards, I mean, the standards are obviously created that bit, that people work hard and they work quick and they're determined. Mm. But say it's something like journalism, the desire to be first rather than be accurate, because you don't want to lose, is really prevalent in their industry, you know, and also in television as well. It was the same thing. So, you know, I think it's calmed down a bit in TV and maybe in journalism now. I'm not so sure, but I mean, I think that's the way with the world went from the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the messages I'm trying to convey is that kind of attitude and behaviour is unhealthy. It's unhealthy because it generates, not only is it stressful and it creates stress in other people. So it's unhealthy for you, but it's unhealthy for the people who have to operate in the environment that you're feeding. Yeah. But secondly, it cuts off the supply of, it turns down the supply of oxytocin, which is a vital hormone.
You're right. When I've arrived in my, I'm looking at Mark, is it the same? Do you feel the same in the industry? Well, when I arrived in the industry, I just felt terrified that I was going to lose my job all the time. I was like, I've got a job in telly. Oh no, I could lose it. Yeah, I was stressed out. I was stressed out a lot. Okay, let's go back to a point you made earlier, which is about you discuss all the different the five chapters. One of the ones, kindness makes us happier. I think we've gone over that. Kindness is good for your heart. What something you touched on a little bit before is kindness slows down aging. I think you should have gone with this one bigger because it's the one that it aims at the vanity. There's 7 ways that you age, you say in your book.
What I did is I broke down 7 processes of aging. And you call them processes of aging because there isn't just an aging organ. You know, you have a brain that you think with and a heart that you that pumps blood, but you haven't got an aging organ. You have you just have underlying things that happen.
Mm.
Like the immune system gradually weakens. It's called immunosenescence. You gradually reduce levels and you lose nitric oxide gradually in the body. There's a process called inflammation. We call it inflammation when you cut yourself, but inflammation occurs in the inside of the body. Scientists now call it inflammaging because it's integrated into the aging process. So inflammation on the inside increases as we age, and it's linked with a whole host of different diseases. So you have these processes of aging, and it turns out there's 7 of them that have been shown to be affected by either direct kindness or compassion, or the substances that kindness and compassion generate, like oxytocin, nitric oxide, for example, or even the fact that compassion itself stimulates the nervous system in a highly specific way, and it turns on the anti-inflammatory response.
Can you slow it? You could slow down the aging process. Can you reverse it?
You can't reverse it.
No.
Well, actually,
really had something,
well,
David.
Actually, Tim, biologically you can to an extent, but not in the sense that I think you're looking for.
I'm looking at the wrinkles in my eyes.
we have 2 ages. You have your chronological age, which is, you know, I was born in 1970, so I'm chronologically 46. But then you have a physiological or a biological age, which is the age of your body. Mm. Now, that actually does go up and down. So someone whose chronological age is 50, but who's had a very unhealthy life for the last 20 years, who has a physiological, i.e. a biological age of 65, who suddenly starts having a healthier lifestyle, eating better, and their biological age reverses. So their biological age comes from 65, and if they keep doing the healthy thing, then they might find in 5 years' time their biological age is 45. So we can reverse aging in the sense that the apparent age of the body is physically younger. You can develop a younger body. Chronologically, you can't reverse, obviously, because years... time is time,
yeah.
But biologically, the internal condition of the body,
but not
absolutely.
The external bit, not the wrinkles.
Well, actually,
we've got something here to work with.
here's some cracking new research that was looking at the process of aging of skin, mm-hmm. right? So the process aging, we talk about, it's called oxidation. So earlier I mentioned, if you leave an apple on the table for a fortnight, it wrinkles, and that's oxidation. It's caused by things called free radicals. The technical name for it is oxidative stress, but it's caused by free radicals. And scientists were studying the oxidation process of the skin, of cells of the skin. And what they found is if you get enough oxytocin, that substance that you create from being kind.
Yeah.
If you get enough oxytocin into the skin, then the oxidation process is dramatically slowed down.
Right.
In other words, skin cells just physically do not age as fast if you can get oxytocin into the skin. Now, there's only one way to get oxytocin into the skin, to generate it in your body. And the only way to generate it is through your behaviour.
Why can't we artificially make oxytocin and then just...
You can artificially make... In fact, they do artificially make it.
So why don't...
Some countries give it to women to induce labour. The synthetic form is called pitocin.
So why can't we just do that a lot more rather than being kind?
because I would never tell people to do that because I actually don't know. To be honest, the synthetic form, when you put it in the body, it doesn't last very long.
Right.
Right. The name oxytocin comes from the Greek for swift birth, because it was always understood that it initiates uterine contractions. So that's why it's given to induce labour. It has a very short half-life. Meaning half-life is a science term for it doesn't last very long.
Right.
But if you generate oxytocin, then the process itself keeps generating it. So it's a wave of it that'll last a lot longer.
Yeah.
So you can't eat oxytocin, nor can you drink it. You can't get it in diet. The only way to get it is through your behaviour. So by behaving in a kind way, then you can actually slow down the oxidation, the wrinkling process of the skin.
It's tough though, isn't it? I said frustrating only that you can't get it across to everyone. It's tough you can't bottle kindness, isn't it? Or put it in a pill or a liquid, because then that'd be an easier sell. Yeah. That's how we...
That's how society is, eh? People, yeah. if that book, instead of being called The Five Side Effects of Kindness, were saying kindness in a pill or something...
Yeah. I'd buy it.
Yeah, yeah. If we could say you can now go into Boots or Tesco and buy a bottle of kindness pills that will slow down 7 processes of aging, that will dilate your arteries and sweep the crap out of your arteries, it will make you feel better. It would be a blockbuster.
Yeah.
Pharmaceutical companies define a blockbuster. This was from my insider days working in the industry. They define a blockbuster as a drug whose annual sales are greater than $1 billion a year.
Wow.
I think a kindness pill, if you could have such a thing to get the physical effects of kindness, would be a billion-dollar blockbuster. And so, what I'm trying to say is people can get that effect. You don't need it in a pill for nothing by just being kind to each other.
People, if it's free, people don't care about it. That's always the problem. It's kindness is free.
Yeah.
How would you go about being kind then? Give us some examples. I mean, of, you know, you're someone just sitting and listening to this podcast now, and you're thinking, well, what can I do to be kind? What are the sort of things you would suggest people start doing?
It's the everyday ordinary things in large numbers that matter. For example, when I came in here, you offered me a glass of water.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't have thought that was being kind because it's just something that you do. But I think it's these small things that are actually meaningful, that are kind. And so I would
say... David, can I just point out that I did offer him tea, coffee or water. It wasn't just water. People think I'm stingy. And you can have a beer if you want.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah. Carry on, David.
Yeah, it's those small, everyday, ordinary things that we do. And I would say just do more of them and be... You know, I challenge people often to do what I call the 7-day kindness challenge.
Yeah, it's run through your book, doesn't it?
It generates a habit. I've put 50 suggestions as little nuggets. Just if you open a page of the book, the chances are you'll find one of them. So, but the 7-day kindness challenge is something that I want people to do, because what it does is it gets you thinking kindness. It gets you looking for opportunities, which sometimes, unless you actually make yourself do it, you might not actively look for opportunities. So by looking for them, you start to notice them. And there's a couple of rules that I put in. It has to be something different every day. You can do the same thing on 2 different days, but it only counts the first time. So you can make someone a cup of... You can give someone a glass of water on one day as your act of kindness, but if you give someone a glass of water on 2 days, all good for you, but it doesn't count.
Right.
You've got to do something different on day 2. The other thing is you've got to push yourself out your comfort zone at least once. So something's got to kind of, you know, be a wee bit challenging for you, you know, whatever that might be. You know, whether you see someone needing your help... Even if it's a woman trying to take her buggy onto the train, and maybe you're not a good people person, so that pushes you out of your comfort zone. I will go over and offer help to that lady. And the third thing, rule or condition, is one of your acts of kindness must be absolutely anonymous, and no one must ever know that it was you, what you did, or that it was you that did And that takes the ego out of it.
What sort of thing?
Well, I can't tell you any things I've done. But, you know, you might just, you know, for example, you might help someone during the day in some meaningful way, but you don't get to tell anyone you did it. You don't get to tell your family that, guess what I did today? You know, helped that person. Or it might be a donation you make to a charity online or a GoFundMe page, but you're not allowed to ever tell anyone what you did.
Since reading your book, I've thought about it a lot, and there's a couple of things. First of all, I think jealousy is a really weird emotion that comes in and can affect kindness. Often that's one which trumps kindness, I think. And especially in jobs like entertainment jobs. And, you know, also, you're an author. If you do well, other people will be jealous of you and won't feel kind towards you. Do you think jealousy is sort of one of these emotions that...
Yeah. But I think it's also something that's learned. I think a lot of these things, these behaviours, are actually learned. You find in other cultures, some of the things that are very prevalent in ours are not quite as obvious there. So I think the way we learn, the way society kind of works for us, teaches us, like you said when you first started in television, it's a cutthroat industry.
Yeah.
And so you learn to treat other people the same way. And it takes someone somewhere to say, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. And so what happens, I think jealousy is something that's learned, because we're taught to be independent. We're taught to strive and strive, whereas other cultures are more interdependent. In other words, their goal is relationships. It is the cultivation of all of us helping each other. Jealousy isn't really a big thing there, yeah. But jealousy is bigger for us because we're taught from an early age it's about striving and being better than other people. So naturally what happens is you start to compare yourself. But the problem is we often downwardly compare ourselves, and that creates that dents our self-esteem, generates unhappiness in many people.
And the other thing I thought, but I'm going to ask you first because otherwise I make myself look stupid, is can you think kind thoughts as well? Does that help?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Absolutely, because, and that is so important.
Right, since reading your book, it has had quite a big effect on me because I'm thinking, trying to think kindness all the time at the moment. That's how I'm trying to do it. And whenever I hear about bad things in the news, I try and see it from their point of view and think kindness, even to thinking about poor King Jong-un. And in North Korea, and thinking, why is he the way he is? What's up with him? And I know everyone just make him out to be this evil dictator, which he is. But I'm thinking, why has he got himself into this state? And I try and think kind thoughts towards him rather than horrible thoughts. Am I doing the right thing?
Yeah, because, and the thing is, in terms of the physiological effects of kindness, thinking kind thoughts does have the same benefit almost as physically being kind. Just like, you know, if you're faced with a stressful situation, it causes you stress. And it's the feelings of stress that cause the buildup of stress hormones in the body. So you can be in a stressful situation, or you can be sitting at home anticipating a stressful situation or remembering one, and the effect on the body is exactly the same.
Yeah.
So you can be being kind or you can be thinking kindness, and the effect on the body is pretty much the same. That, coming back to the King Jong-un thing, people might think of that as a religious and a spiritual thing, but I think our natural tendency is that we should be looking for what is up with these people, you know, what's wrong. We should be feeling compassion. Yet it doesn't sound like the, you know, what a thing to say given the atrocities. But at the same time, we can't shut off our natural tendency to be compassionate. We've got to let it out somewhere. So we can let it out, then we can question it and say, oh, okay, but he has to pay for his crimes. Yeah. But at the same time, my natural tendency, like a child, like a mother, sorry, has a natural tendency to love her child, even if her child has murdered someone. The mother she still has her natural tendency to care. So I think we should develop that and see where it goes, see where the conversation takes us.
I just think there seems to be a lot of aggression going on at the moment, and especially in politics in the world. And and since I've read your book, I've just been trying to look at it and go, hey, what if everyone was just kind to each other instead?
Yeah, amazing.
but it would be amazing, yeah. But whether it could happen,
I turned on the TV a wee while ago and I watched, you know, a debate in Parliament. And they were behaving like children.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
It was ridiculous. It was a disgrace.
I think everyone should be made to go to, I know it take a long time for get all the 65 million people in the country, but they should all be made to go and watch Question Time. Because when you go there, it's hysterical. It's just so childish.
It
and you're like,
childish.
Oh, why can't you just, you know, you've got the, even if they agree with each other, they can't, because it's just a battle of power. It's madness in there. And it's the shouting and the screaming. And it's just, these are people running our country.
That's the problem, because what happens is that makes it okay for other people to behave like that.
Well, you've got the leader of the free world threatening everybody.
Exactly.
And you've got, you know, us doing it, the North Korea. Everybody's threatening each other at the moment.
I know, and that fuels everybody else, a lot of people who are waiting on someone telling them how to behave.
Yeah.
And if the leaders are telling them, we want to fight people and punch them and I want to be bigger and stronger than you, you're smaller, we've got more this than you, what that does is it just encourages other people to do the same. What we should be doing right at the top is setting an example by being kind, by finding a way. I'm not a politician. I don't know what it's like for these people.
I'm being kind
to them.
Yeah.
I don't really know what it's like for Donald Trump, for Theresa May, for King Jong-un. I don't know what context of life they have at all. But I'm sure it is possible to do it more kindly.
I've read a few books from politicians, and I met a few. In fairness to them, they all start out with good intentions. They all, I think, generally kind people who want to do something. And then when you get involved, you end up in a game.
Yeah.
As we all know, it's a game and it's a power game, and you have to play the game, and then it becomes difficult for them. So yeah, so it becomes quite hard for
them.
It's
difficult.
Yeah, to negotiate their well around.
You can actually see some politicians. I mean, I didn't mean to put Theresa May in the same sentence as Kim Jong-un. That was not intentional at all. But you can see her and other politicians, they do have natural compassion. They are trying to do good, but it's difficult given the context that they're up against, given the environment they're in. It's easier for some people to be kind than it is for others. Depends on the context of your life.
I didn't expect this podcast to go to world politics, but there you go. That's what happened. We're going to go into our four questions, but just finally, before that, we've missed out something huge, I think, which we started the podcast with right at the beginning. And actually, it could maybe be one of your points for the questions in a minute. But meditating kindness is huge, in your opinion, isn't it? And that's what it also. That's where it all started
Absolutely.
From. How do you do that, and why should you do it?
Right. Very, very simply, you can sit quietly and you can think of people that are important to you in your life. And you can think of all the reasons why you value that person and why you're grateful for that person being in your life. And by doing that, you start to build an appreciation and a sense of emotional warmth towards them that might already be there, but you intensify it. You can also do the same thing for random people, person that you see at work, one of the people on the set on Sunday brunch that you don't really know, and you can think of, I appreciate that person, look at the job they do, and you start to generate a little bit of warmth towards what you call neutral people. And then the technique goes, you start to generate a set of sense of warmth towards people who are challenging, who cause you stress, difficult people. And then you try to develop a sense of warmth towards all sentient beings, so all of life.
Humans. Which is what we were just discussing with world politics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So even if you have to put a show of strength, if you're the leader of the free world, when you go home at night, think nice thoughts about people who you might be attacking.
So that's actually a structured meditation called the loving kindness meditation. You actually start with yourself, where you generate a feeling of warmth towards yourself. You can use words to help you look, may I be filled with loving kindness and be well, peaceful and at ease, happy, free of suffering. That's the standard text that they use in that meditation. But you don't have to use the words. You can literally just think of the people and generate a feeling of warmth. It's the feeling that starts to generate with practice that's actually bringing about the physical effects in the body.
Whenever I can't sleep at night now, I remember something said by Haman Suman, the Buddhist, I'm looking over there because I've got his book, which I love, but the Buddhist monk who came, I met him on Sunday brunch, and he always says, he just does this one thing, if you're feeling sad, go and look in your children's eyes. Wow. And it's hard then to feel sad, and I just think of my children and happy thoughts about them playing and stuff, and it just takes the angst away, and it does work. So
Absolutely.
It makes you, is he,
gives is you he the guy who wrote that book, Things You Can Only Do When You Slow Down?
Yeah.
Something. Yeah, I've got that. I'm reading
that
now.
Book.
I'm reading that right now.
Oh, yeah, it's very good.
Amazing.
Isn't it?
Really
it's a very
good.
It's a very good book. It'll make you feel calm and nice about yourself. Right, four questions we ask everyone who comes on this podcast. What advice have you given that has been invaluable to your life?
That it's the thought that counts. My mum taught me from an early age that more important than the gifts you give is the meaning behind it, is the intent behind it. If your intention is to help, is to be kind, then that is more important than the physical thing itself. And that has something that's helped me so many times throughout my life, that it's the thought that counts. It's the thought behind it that matters.
Good advice. Right, what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that can help them?
When you feel a little bit of stress or anxiety coming on, take a deep breath. Just stop it, take a sharp intake of breath. And what it does is it moves resources to the front of the brain. It gets you out of the stress cycle right away. And if you do it a sharp intake, and it immediately brings the resources to the front. And then for the next three or four breaths, just pay attention to the fact that you're breathing. And it's a very simple, very quick way to deal with an arising feeling of anxiousness or stress. Just takes you out of it, but it's a physical movement of resources in the brain, which is very useful to know that, because you're more likely to do it.
Mm, Great advice. What mistake do people make? It could be in your job or it could be...
Trying to accomplish too many things. What I've learned over the years is I might have a lot of things to do, but we slow ourselves down if we try to do a bit of everything. And I found it's much easier to accomplish more if I say, okay, I'm going to tackle that thing first. And then when it's finished, I'll move on to that thing. Then when it's finished, I'll move on to that thing. And I found that I achieve and accomplish a lot more by breaking it down like that than trying to do everything at the same time. Okay. I think a lot of people do the same.
And finally, any life hacks?
A really good one for when you feel anxious or fearful, then what's happening is the region of the brain activated is the fear and anxiety centers. It's when you're in a state of what's called distress.
Yeah.
But there's two kinds of stress. There's distress, which is what we normally think of as stress, but there's also eustress. And eustress is beneficial stress. Some people think of it as the stress that you feel when you're driving at something that you really want to accomplish. But actually, another major form of eustress is laughter or lightheartedness. And so one of the ways you can move your brain, you can catch yourself as these resources go backwards to the stress, fear and anxiety, or fear or anxiety areas, to catch them in mid-flow is to burst into a silly little ridiculous little dance, like, you know, victory dance.
He's doing one now. He's really doing one.
But yeah. You do it like a silly, stupid dance, and you've got to do it long enough. It might take 10 seconds or a minute. You've got to do it long enough until you naturally smile. And when you're naturally smiling, it's tugging on this muscle here. It's called your zygomaticus major. When that happens...
He's pointing to his cheeks. Yeah.
When that happens, it means that your brain is in a state of eustress. It's like a coin. You can't flip a coin and be head and tails at the same time. The brain cannot be in distress and eustress at the same time. It's actually impossible. It can only be one or the other. So a good hack is to literally shunt the brain from distress into eustress. Much easier than trying to think happy thoughts is to physically move your body in a lighthearted way. And it shunts the resources to the front and it shunts you into eustress.
Once on Sunday brunch, we did laughter therapy. And it was hysterical because it was. But after 10, 20 seconds of doing laughter therapy, you're laughing for real.
Yeah.
And you just feel brilliant. Yeah, and everyone like taking the mickey out of us on social media, everything. But it is amazing.
Because
you're going, ha, 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 ha. And then you start laughing, really. It's so stupid. Yeah. I suppose it's a similar sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. The brain cannot be in distress and eustress at the same time. It's
David, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. The 5 Side Effects of Kindness is out now. It's a very good read. And it's one of those books that you should gift to someone because it's one of those things that might help them and their life, especially if they're in a stressful time in their life at the moment. So. What?
Buy it for someone, it's an act of kindness.
Yeah, buy it for someone, it's an act of kindness, Mark says. So there you go. Where can people, if they want to, are you on Twitter, social media?
I'm on social media, Twitter, Facebook.
What are the addresses?
Twitter is Dr. Hamilton, D-R-D-R Hamilton. Facebook and Instagram, it's David R. Hamilton, PhD. You would think I would have synced them all up, but it just didn't.
Doesn't matter.
I joined at different times. Yeah. And my website is drdavidhamilton.com.
Okay. And where's that blog that people can read about?
It's on my website.
It's on your website. Okay. Yeah. Anything else coming up in the future? Another book on this?
Possibly. I'm writing another book at the moment, actually, but it's not on that subject. It's just kind of trying to blend kind of science and the world of science and the world of spirituality.
Ah, brilliant. Once you've written that, can you come back on?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks so much, David.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Mark, what did you make of David Hamilton?
I really enjoyed that, and I didn't want to say it to his face, but I was thinking while he was talking, you'd have to be really stupid to ignore him. I think because he's got it on two levels here.
Yeah,
I think he's got the scientific level, which you can't argue with, and just a practical level of actually being nice to people.
You listen to yourself being kind, and
I mean, if you ignore him, I just think you're daft. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, being kind's a nice way to live your
life.
But
also, if it's going to improve your own life.
Do you know my one regret, Mark, is I've got a big mouth and I also have strange thoughts. And
no.
Yeah.
No,
and
no,
why did I go down the King John cul-de-sac. Why did I take poor David down
why
there?
Why you took him down?
Why did I take David down the...
I was thinking I might have to put that tangent alert in.
My strange mind works like that, and it's like I was sitting there thinking, and I don't know why, but anyway. And then you've got to, I start panicking because I start thinking people are going to go, what about all the human rights stuff? And we weren't ever saying that.
Atrocities, violations.
But we weren't actually saying that.
No, you weren't saying that, but it could be taken out of
context.
People
look at that, and I just led our guests down that.
Yeah.
Horrible
Kim Jong Un cul-de-sac. You wouldn't move to that estate, would you?
And I was like, oh, why am I doing this? Please.
He comes up quite, him and Trump come up quite a lot. I think I might start calling you Tim Jong Un.
I just think they're big people in the world at the moment. They're
your idols.
You've got posters on my wall of both of them together in a big love heart. Anyway, that's it for this podcast. Come back next week. Do you know what we have next Monday, which is very exciting? We have The Other Side of the Affair, written from a lady's point of view who had someone have an affair on them. Does that make sense? They had an affair and she was on the receiving... No, she was on the receiving end of the affair. What does that mean?
It's slick, isn't it?
I know. What is it? How do you describe this? The affair happened. Her husband had an affair. There you go. And what it's like to be on the other side of the
affair. I had a good thought there, and you've just blown it out of my head with that nonsense.
Let's leave it there, then. We will see you all on Monday. Bye.
See ya.